So I'm Alex.
I'm Jared. Mm-hmm.
And we're recording
The Veterans Experience of Michael E. Peterson. I'm Mike Peterson. I was born in Orange, California, August 6, 1948, to Carl and Idella Peterson. I enlisted in the Marine Corps in March of 67. What date, I don't know, off the top of my head. I served in Vietnam from basically January 1968 to 69, extending my tour twice for the combined action platoons, twice being 2 6-month extensions. I was discharged in February 1970.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. So what was your actual job in the Marine Corps?
2531, being a field radio operator. Okay. That constituted 2 weeks of field radio school. Not quite a grunt, but humping a prick 25, field radio, but not the larger supplies of radio stocks. That implied a further training, 6 months training versus 2 weeks that I had.
Where did you receive this training?
Camp Pendleton, California.
Was this close to where you went to boot camp?
Yes, San Diego boot camp. The Marines consisted west of the Mississippi. MCRD was in San Diego with further infantry training at Camp Pendleton. East of the Mississippi was Camp Lejeune, South Carolina, for boot camp. And then shipped over to Camp Pendleton for the, combat infantry training or MOS training, generally.
Were you drafted or did you volunteer?
I enlisted. I was a Guppy. I believed in Vietnam at the time.
Yeah.
Incidentally, it was I was educated post-Vietnam in at UC Riverside, and one of my instructors was Mel Gertov, who has since risen to heading political science department at Portland State University, and who also wrote the initial chapters of what later became known as the Pentagon Papers. So he dissuaded me from the war.
Guys, are you going to order some food today?
Accepting the propaganda of the war. The propaganda of the war. I was a true believer at the time. Unlike my teen colleagues, I knew actually where Laos was at the time of, and our immediate involvement in 62 was the Plain of Jars, not Vietnam. That was the flashpoint. Vietnam came later, although we had training missions in Vietnam at the time. The flashpoint was the Plain of Jars. And I knew that. I kept abreast of National Geographic and the whole nine yards. So I knew actually what I was doing. But go on.
What made you decide that it was something that you wanted to get behind?
I believed in the war, and especially, I don't know when it was, the Life magazine article, To Keep a Village Free, they headlined the combined action platoons as the U.S. Marines' other war in Vietnam. And I wanted to go there. And I didn't know that it was when my first tour was up and I read about it in my Liberty, that was 30 Days Free Liberty. Then you had to do extension. No, I don't, it was before the first tour, I'm sure of that, like in 67. And I wanted to be there, to be at the CAPS, but in the first tour, as you know, you go where you're assigned. But your extensions, you're granted a tour of duty, usually in your home unit, but I extended for the CAPS. So my first tour of duty was with Comm Company, Headquarters Battalion, 1st Marine Division, headquartered in Da Nang. I extended my tour twice, 2 6-month extensions for the Combined Action Program, and CAP School was in Da Nang for 2 weeks, and followed to assignment to one of 4 combined action groups. First CAG was south in fruit. I forget the name. South of Da Nang. The first one, the second one was in Da Nang. The third one was in Phu Bai, and the fourth one was in Quang Tri at the DMZ. The fourth CAG literally had no right to be there because it was contested territory. And we, the CAPs were a platoon, a squad of Marines, teamed with a platoon of Vietnamese popular forces, and we patrolled in the hamlets. As I say in the book, unlike the Marine grunt units and the Army grunt units, we waged our war in the hamlets rather than on the hamlets. So we knew, the Vietnamese had three dimensions, unlike the background of the grunts, the war became, I don't know, I think it's personal. I'm grabbing on like a mouth here, and I'm winding down.
Oh, it's okay. It's your interview.
Yeah. stop the tape. Okay, I'll gather my thoughts then. But keep on going. Okay.
I can ask you a question here. So what were some of your first thoughts as soon as you arrived in Vietnam?
Oh my! not my first thoughts. The closer I got to actually going to Vietnam, the more I wanted not to go. not my first thoughts. My first experience was a panic and not knowing where Comm Company Headquarters Battalion 1st Marine Division was. I assumed it was up north. I mean, I heard Scuttlebutt saying 1st Marine Division was transferred to Phu Bai. That was headquarters of 3rd Marine Division, so I spent a week, spent the first, about 48 hours transferring north to Phu Bai and Hue City, where I should have stayed in Da Nang. I flew in a KC-130. And these were my colleagues. It was a team of Marines returning from medevac. here's a raw, raw new guy, FNG, and he's stuck among a bunch of Marines, medevac, and returning to their units after medevac. Who was your unit? Alpha Company 3-1. And, they were wiped out, and I'm the sole survivor. So it was just like, So I was grateful upon my learning of return to Da Nang and hopefully a more stable existence.
So how long were you in Vietnam before you were able to shake the image of being the new guy, or FNG,
Boy.
And for our listeners, that's FNG is the
fucking new guy. Yeah. It was like about 2 or 3 months. Yeah, mostly I stood guard duty. I hated the idea of standing watch at the first Marine Division command headquarters and all those lifers around. So I made it a regular assignment to guard duty, kills 200 and through 244. That was the comm company's assigned billet for guard duty. To those who are not involved, the Marines tactical area of responsibility was south of Da Nang, and Chulai, from the south to the DMZ in the north. That was the Marines' responsibility. And Da Nang was the headquarters of the 1st Marine Division, as well as the NSA, Naval Support Activity, in Da Nang, because Da Nang featured a deep water port. And So that was pretty well built up. Go on.
For when you did your first tour, before you extended it, how was it different than when you extended your tour?
Well, it was in the rear with the gear. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, there was no... The Marines have the best chow in the... you don't... Like the Marines said, you don't fuck with my chow and you don't fuck with my mail. You know? And the division chow was like stateside chow. You know, white and chocolate milk, for example, flown over from Foremost.
Which and, I'm assuming was normally unheard of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The main, the regiments were Bravo rats, you know, rations from a can. But the Marines generally took care of their own in the built-up areas. The 24th Corps, by way of example, that was in Fubai. That was at a core level. And their chow, you know, this is, you know, more built up than the 1st Marine Division's area. Their chow sucked, by comparison. So just sort of, But yeah, just for those two things, the Marines didn't fuck with.
What was one thing that was, or was there, I should say, anything that was kind of like a pleasant surprise that you weren't expecting when you went to Vietnam?
Or an unpleasant surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, oh boy. The pleasant surprise was mostly reserved for the CAPs. We were isolated from the Vietnamese. You know there were the cleaning women and you know, it's the support authority. The Freedom Hill Theater, or PX base, was about 2 kilometers away, and that featured an air-conditioned stateside theater, barber shops, and, you know, available to Navy and Marines and all kinds of personnel. The Da Nang airstrip that we flew into was nearby there. Let's see, where is Mike going with this? So it was built up, and the CAPs, on the other hand, were in the hamlets 24/7, with an occasional R&R to the, you know, at 24th Corps, you know, for recharging. But that didn't last maximum 24 hours. And then we were in the boonies with resupply once or twice a week. But we were on our own. We had, of course, combat support, artillery and medevac, and, you know. But there were limits as to what we could call in because we were in the hamlets, and, you know, we had to be very selective in our firing. And that was self-selective. You know, we were sensitive to the needs of the hamlet. That's a key difference from the rest of the grunt experience, both Army and Marines. I think we made a difference. And, you know, ultimately we did not, but we made a difference in our hand. So in the main, my recollections of the combined action platoons were good. We checked the grunt impulse to waste them all, you know. And, you know, okay, now these are our friends, and, you know, we're searching for the enemy, and so, like, we're all kind of in one big bag living together. You know, you got you know, the same family had Viet Cong as well as government of Vietnam relationships, and you had the, you know, kind of like pick and choose who is the least dangerous or who is the most dangerous, you know, and so it's, we had an impact on the hamlet. The level of destruction was nothing like the level of destruction of the free fire zones, for example.
How were relations with your family while you were away in Vietnam?
Pardon?
How were the relations with your family while you were away in Vietnam?
Oh, mom and dad. Well, I didn't have any girlfriend, mom and dad, well, dad was, I was a late baby, and my dad had been in Smedley Butler's regiment in 1929, and the American Expeditionary Force in China. And he remembers Butler as being, you know, a big nose, and he constantly tugged on his nose and wiped his ass. But you know more than her. Smedley Butler's maverick reputation. I think I really believe that, you know, when the tape was inactive, some of our most important conversations were here. You know, the Marines, by and large, is lockstep mentality, but they produced a few mavericks. Chesty Puller being one, Lew Walt being another one, and Lewis Walt was a trainee of Chesty Puller's academy during the 30s. The Small Wars Manual Academy, and that was the template of future operations. And above all, it featured a sensitivity to local conditions and cultures and stuff like that, something which the Army never knew. And Lew Walt later became commander of all the Marine forces in Vietnam. And Lew Walt and Victor Krulak it was with their blessing that Combined Action Program was formed. So there's this distinction between Lew Walt and the CAP program. And who was the general, who was the commandant that was against the Vietnam War?
I'm thinking of wrong names.
What?
I'm thinking like, he was later.
No, he at the time was an opponent of the Vietnam War. Oh God. Again, aphasia. Yeah. that's the name for your mental block of between the brain and the mouth. Two-time Medal of Honor winner from Tarawa. Now pause. So, the Marines produced, in addition to the what I'll call the lockstep mentality, free thinkers like Smedley Butler and Commandant Shute, and to a lesser extent, Lew Walt. And it was this attitude, I think, that gave the Marines some flexibility. And in addition, General Westmoreland, he ran the war overall. But Chief of the Naval Pacific Command, at their insistence, they gave the Marines wide latitude for their conduct of the war in Vietnam in their area of responsibility. So, just with these subtle nuances. Generally, again, we conducted our war the same as the Army with these examples, less damage to the hamlets. Victor Krulak said we ought to wage our war in the hamlets rather than in the mountains. The war is in the hamlets. We got to wage war there rather than free fire zones that the Army emphasized.
And the flexibility that you talked about with the free thinkers, do you mean flexibility
well,
in the conduct of the war?
I think overall we were of the same mentality. So that flexibility in the conduct of the war can be carried too far. We subscribed, as the Army did, to Luke the Gook, you know, and all the other adjectives. But the Marines should have known better because of the small wars experience, because of the interbellum between World Wars I and II. We had all these brush fire wars and conflicts. Sandinistas, you know, we eliminated in Sandino, in Nicaragua, you know, and it was just, but we did it in such a way that we didn't level this massive destruction that we did in Vietnam.
So upon your return from Vietnam, were your opinions any way transformed about our involvement?
That was Mel Gertov, you know, Mel Gertov's influence. I had always felt we were, with the CAP experience, directly with the CAP experience, I felt we were waging our war in the wrong way. We still had business there, but this is before 1970 to 72. My feelings were mixed. I still felt we belonged there, but if we were going the way we had been going, I felt we would be driven out. You know, I didn't expect the complete rout of in 75, but I felt we would be driven out. But we needed to wage our war on the Hamlet level. The Hamlet's the key, you know, and stuff like that. And that would be make or break, but it wasn't. And so I felt we were doomed at some extent or another at some time. Incidentally, this there was one of the key turning points that there, this is a might have been scenario. In 63, the phrase that was common among most advisors was sink or swim with nose in Diem. If Diem didn't make it, we should be out of there. If Diem could possibly pull it off, then there could be a reason for our continued presence. But you know, that was one alternative not taken. Sink or swim with nose in Diem, boom. Our deaths would have been in the hundreds rather than in the tens of thousands. So, but that was an opportunity not taken. But anyway, to the present. But Mel Gertov, who was mostly concerned with the background of China and the context in Vietnam and the Cold War, and this is like pre-Vietnam and China, because he spoke Chinese. He convinced me and us that it was hopeless cause, that we were not propagandized, but we were doomed 9/10 of the time. Ho Chi Minh is Bac Ho, Uncle Ho, and to the south as well as the north. Well, we didn't know that, see. And Ron Phillips, the late Ron Phillips, you don't know him, and I don't need to go into details, said, I knew we were in trouble the day Ho Chi Minh died and South Vietnam went into mourning. Okay. We're on the wrong side.
Now, it seems like a lot of Vietnam vets are very aware of political and historical issues within Vietnam. Now, do you have an idea why that is?
Or was that your experience?
Well, I don't know. Well, actually, the older Vietnam vets get, the more they resort to what I'll call the hat organizations. That's the piss cutters and the American Legion and the VFW, and it's an increasing conservatism that belies the earlier experience from Vietnam. It's as if we've got to make it mean something. All those lives wasted for the cause, I can't accept that.
So it's nostalgia.
Pardon?
It's nostalgia.
Nostalgia has a powerful effect, contrary to the wisdom of history. We were fighting an uphill battle at best.
Do you think a lot of people still don't still have that mentality if they were part of the Caps?
Oh, boy. That's hard to say. I feel like
you can almost see the good in what you did because of what specifically you were helping with, rather than the entire war on a whole where you have to try to justify it.
I'll put it this way. My experience with the Caps determined my involvement with Veterans Vietnam Restoration Project. Because the Vietnamese in my hamlet, our hamlet, assumed three dimensions, assumed more than background poster effect, of course I wanted to go back to Vietnam. And with all the positive and negatives of that experience, the most shameful thing I personally did was as a member of the CAPS. I condoned torture on two occasions. That is the shameful part of my memory. We did a precursor to the waterboard treatment. We called it soaping down. We held down the victim, and we covered his mouth with the washcloth, and we rubbed soap into it. And that gave the victim not only suffocation, but also, unbeknownst to us, damaged his or her digestion. And that created, again, that was unbeknownst to us, a lifelong problem for the victim, and to that the victims of the soap treatment suffer to this day. That's the one single thing I'm ashamed of. Let's see.
Do you think going back kind of in a way was to help alleviate your own personal thoughts of that situation?
Well, not that directly. That was war, and the Vietnamese among themselves treated their prisoners far worse, among the Southerners as well as the Northerners. So we exercised considerably tame tactics,
yeah.
But the Viet Cong suspects that we sent back into the to the rear for interrogation, we didn't want to know what they went through.
Yeah, definitely.
So, let's see. So I, it's just in general. What are things like in Vietnam? I thought in my. It was not beyond my hope that with the mission winding up, that I could visit my old area of operations in between Phu Bai and Wei City. But that was not to be. Vung Tau is in the extreme south around Saigon. The Marines' area of responsibility is 500 miles to the north. I traveled halfway around the world only to be halted the last 500 miles. So. This is one reason why I'm hopeful in April of accompanying the last team before it disestablishes itself in Hue City. And so I'm confident I'll get to visit my area of operations then.
How'd you get involved in that?
The same reason, the Veterans Vietnam Restoration Project, yeah.
So
team 1 of
working.
VVRP. Is an 89 and team 29 is slated to go for April before the project disestablishes itself. This is the last mission.
Wow.
So I feel I've come full circle in VVRP as well as Vietnam.
Yeah, so. Wow. That's, how long has it been since you've been over there?
20 years, 89. Do the math.
Yeah, 25.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
That's great. That's got to be really exciting for you.
Oh, yeah, and for Jan, and Jan, my wife, too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, okay, Janet Peterson is my wife, Sarah Peterson is our daughter. Okay. Janet's more stressed about going to Vietnam than I am.
Has she been before?
Or? Oh, no.
Oh,
she's,
okay, wow.
Yeah, she's, and she's dealing with an alien culture. She was Southern California kid. What foreign language she had was Spanish, and she spent a week in Mexico. And, with that culture, But this is a totally foreign culture, so she's more stressed out than I am. So yeah. But you know, she suffered an appendicitis attack with my first mission. We were in a state of such hostility that communication between the States and Vietnam was impossible at that time. And so she suffered a burst appendix during the tour, and I had no way of contacting her. And so it was like Sherry Clark Prakash ran our mail to us, and that was on a weekly basis only. So Jan had an appendix burst. Our pastor's wife watched over her in the time I was in Vietnam, and so there was a call. I administered the call. There was a landline from Saigon, Vung Tau to Saigon. Saigon had to launch a satellite communication, not just any satellite, but a third world satellite because of our official hostility to Vietnam. And that satellite beamed down, not to the States, but Canada, and a landline established from Canada to the States. And so it was 2 hours later, I heard a week, I'm okay.
So
the level of hostility between Vietnam and 1989 was that intense. We allowed practically no humanitarian aid, despite the State Department statements to the contrary. We allowed for no diplomatic aid, humanitarian aid, and let alone normalization of relations otherwise. We knocked down a lot of areas, Team One did. Anyway, back to the war.
Although that's all technology included.
Yeah.
You're doing a service that you feel is very valuable to the Vietnam people, the people of Vietnam, and you know other veterans. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, well, especially for today, given the normalization of relations, vets can afford to be somewhat stressed out. Right? Yeah. The Vietnamese can handle that. I would recommend a trip to Vietnam for any Vietnam veteran whose PTSD is copable, who can be dealt with. It was very healing for me and our team, and I recommend it.
Does it provide you with a sense of closure?
You know, I had that closure with Vietnam earlier. With the fall of the South, I got in one of my depressions, and I handled the pistol, and I put it, well, I didn't quite put it to my head. Browning 9mm, I said I was suicidal before. But then I figured, you know, it was with the fall of the South, and that triggered a response in me. And I handled the gun, and I knew I had handled the gun once before, but a part of me denied it, you know. That part washed away, and so I knew I could do it, but then I would do it. And a cold, deadly feeling washed all over me. And that scared the hell out of me. So I put it away and haven't had a suicidal thought since then.
And was that your kind of...
That was my down... That was the downtime. That was in 75. By the mid-80s, that had been dealt with. And in 2000, Doug Grameon, who was a member of the CAP team, dealt with another area of shame I had to carry, and that was the killing of a Marine and in an ambush initiated by the ARVN, which was the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. It left me alive to blame myself for the Marine I felt responsible for killing in front of me, and the wounding of the Marine behind me, which left me untouched to blame myself because I was commander of that CAP platoon, CAP squad. And so God bless Doug Remyon in 2000. He called me on a Doug Remyon, you know, the VVA locator. Doug Remyon, that name sounds familiar. And it sure as hell, it was Doug Remyon, who had been volunteered for the CAP unit a week before he was put in my platoon. And he said, "Didn't you know the Arvin weren't where they were supposed to be? They were ghosting." And so we had stumbled into an accidental ambush. And, you know, the locations, as you know, are phoned in daily. Locations of friendly units. And so we plotted our ambush away from the friendly units. Well, they weren't where they were supposed to be. They were ghosting. And we stumbled into their ghosting outfit, their ghost positions. So I was unaware of this at the time in 1970, and which left me 20 years to blame myself, 80s and 90s. And in 2000, I contacted this Doug Remyon, and he said, "Didn't you know? The Arvin weren't where they were supposed to be." Mm. In other words, it wasn't my fault, after all. I carried the burden for, you know, damn near 30 years.
So what was your source of motivation to write your book, The Combined Action Platoons, available on Amazon?
last scene, because the publication, first and only publication, was like about 3,000 max books. So if you want to hurry, contact Amazon now. It was the basis of my thesis, and that in turn was the basis of Glenn May's History of the Vietnam War, which I thought I'd skate through, you know, easy A stuff, you know. So Glenn May wasn't so accommodating, so it was the basis of my history paper, and it grew from that paper. And it was more than, you know, it was a graduate paper, not an undergraduate paper, so it was a more detailed. And it blossomed forth into my thesis, The Combined Action Platoons, which I've sent a copy to the library. And that actually has more of the civic action projects. This is like, one half to two-thirds of the total work of that stuff, which is located in the, you know, in the master thesis section of the University of Oregon Library. Where am I going with this?
Did you receive a lot of support from some of the historians, the Marines, at the university?
Yeah, Glenn May,
or even Marines, a lot of Marines you served with, were they able to help you out with this?
The basis was phone interviews with 20 or 30 Marines, I don't know the questions. It's attached in my appendix at the University of Oregon Library. Where am I going with this? The basic Gerald Fry and one of the graduate faculty advisors served as my thesis team, and I got support from them, obviously, but I had to make it related to international studies. So what is more interesting than community development in times of war, when the very essence of community destruction is involved? So it had to be the Combined Action Program as a source for community development in something so destructive as the war overall. And I had a project or two that I contacted CARE, and I was able to demonstrate those projects in the light of the whole Vietnam War, that served as the basis for my thesis. It was accepted, and I said, this serves as the basis for a book. You know, I didn't consider myself so arrogant as to be a writer, but one of the biggest mistakes is I should have sent my thesis to Ron Borum in Ontario, California, who had a master's in English, and he'd have tightened it up. But that's one of the coulda, shoulda done.
Who's your audience for this book?
This is an academic imprint. So it's very nature. It's expense. it was $89 to begin with, and I don't know what it is now. I wrote in the style as best I could to where it was accessible. Obviously the CAP Marines, and segments of it are published on the CAP website. I was surprised when Prager accepted it, actually. You know, because it was like chock full of errors, and you know, I felt it was okay for a master's thesis, but it wasn't fit for publication into a book. So I was as surprised as anyone they accepted it. I think in my brain, Prager as an entity wasn't quite up to snuff on things Vietnam, and it was a rush job for them. And okay, we got our official Vietnam history of this year, and we'll leave it at that.
When did you right after you got out, did you immediately go to school, or what was the thought process behind that?
I went to work.
Okay.
I went to school a year later in Ontario, California, Chaffee Community College for my AA, UC Riverside for my BA in 1979. Ugh. Yeah, 79. And I spent 2 years on Catalina Island with my parents who moved over there. Met my wife there in around 78, 79. We were married in 79 and moved to Oregon in 1980. And I wrote my thesis, of course, in 87, 88.
So you only did your master's up there, right?
Yes.
So why did you decide on Oregon?
We had relatives, my cousins were the fishers on Upper Camp Creek Road, and so we had a place to stay, and unlike California, the cost of living was cheap here, and the recession of 1980 to 83 hadn't hit yet, so there were jobs. My professional experience is restaurant, I'm a cook. And so there were plenty of cooking jobs available, and Jan and I were each interested in pursuing a master's. She in an MBA in accounting, an MBA in accounting was what she ended up with. And I, being more nebulous, a master was political science of some nature, and gravitated toward international studies of the East Asian emphasis. So that's how we ended up here.
Had the military influenced your decision on going to college at all?
Yeah.
Just did you always want to?
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
I entered Chaffee College prior to my service and promptly flunked out. So the draft was breathing down my neck, and so I believed in Vietnam anyway. Mm-hmm. So, no, I've just been in the Marine Corps.
Right. What made you decide on the Marine Corps?
Like father, like son. But, yeah, the closer I got to actually serving in Vietnam, the less I became enamored with it.
Okay, how about one last question here? Would you do it all again?
No. The trauma of getting a Marine, as let alone Vietnamese, killed, dictates my lack of my. I wouldn't do it all over again. I had some positive experience. Yeah, most of the time, you know the score. Most of the time is boring in country, and you know, just sheer tons of boredom. You know, punctuated by moments of terror. You know, that I'm sure you've heard that phrase. It's true. It's true. The smell. Okay, the sounds of the Vietnam War. I'm more enamored with the texture of Vietnam than anything. Well, not than anything else, but the sounds of the Vietnam War were Hueys. The distinctive chop chop of that blades. You find any Vietnam vet, and if there's still a Huey in service, he'll look up at it. I'll stake my reputation on it. He'll look up at it to this day. The distinctive chop of that sound, the Bell UH-1B, is distinctive. And the smell of Vietnam is burning shit. And that smell is not duplicated anywhere. And also combined, in my case, with the smell of rot and perfume and rebirth all rolled into one in Vietnam. And so it's just, and I've got an interesting story. I paid my respects to the wall in 1988 when I wrote this thesis, 87-88. I was granted a scholarship by the Marine Corps to study at their historical archives in the Navy Historical Yard. So I was granted interview access to what his name is, Krulak Follies, the command diaries of the regiments, and do that. And so I paid my obligatory visit to the wall. And Hueys were in service then, even, you know, what the choppers now is a what?
MV-22 Osprey. Now. And we still have Hueys, but they're now four blade.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't expect the sound to emerge from the wall. So I paid, you know, Thomas Williams. This is for you, Tom. Thomas Williams. I had them engrave Thomas Williams, and it is impressive. But the sound I didn't expect. The sound was, it radiated from the wall of the Huey background courier traffic that goes back and forth to Washington, And I didn't expect the sound, which actually radiated from the wall to me, the Huey traffic. Yeah. That was unexpected.
Yeah.
And well, it's my skin crawl to this day.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much too. That's good. Feel free to fill out, or you know. I'll leave. My thesis is in the history. This is my last book, and for Sarah, so I can't give you this. But I think my book is in the library, as well as my thesis. But I would urge you to read my thesis, because it's got a lot more civic action projects, and that's civic action oriented.
Let's
eat. In generations.
So, what role did your father have in you deciding to serve as a Marine?
Well, my father recommended against it. So, he didn't discourage it, but he sure didn't recommend it because he knew I'd get myself. I wasn't sure what I was. I didn't have knowledge of what I was getting into, and he couldn't impart that. But even he, in 1929, the Marines were different than World War II. Qualitatively different. He not only served under Smedley Butler, which I think widened, I don't know if it widened his eyes, but being a commander and being interested in saving American lives rather than American property, which the Americans were expected to do, for example, that made it the mission qualitatively different. And so the Marines were more the State Department's army rather than the military. The World War II changed all that because of the draft and the need for expansion into, what, 5 divisions from, like, say, 2 divisions or maybe even 1 division. So there is a loss of coherence. And I would say the beginnings of a ruthlessness the Marines didn't have before. And that includes weapons training as a result of World War II. The Marines in my time, and certainly your time, were taught to kill the enemy. One of the more revealing lessons and of obvious concern to the military was that by and large the Marines in World War II and the Army, certainly the Army, fired their weapons into the air. Like about 89%, or, you know, there's a number, like it's more than 75%. 89% were confirmed fired rather than shooting the enemy dead. The Marines and the Army made sure that didn't happen during Vietnam, and especially in post-Vietnam era. You hit that target. But it's just like there's a, not a progression toward brutality, but that way, as a result, there's a brutalization. And I'll say it's across the services. And I would expect it for the military. You know, you better learn to kill, you know, and ask questions later. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yes, I did, of course.